Okay, so that title's a bit of a mouthful, I'm afraid, and I doubt whether I can deliver on whatever promise it might actually hold, but I will try. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to give a very brief overview of a project that myself and co-investigators there undertook and resolved when it was basically we were doing interviews with a laptop manufacturer, a very large global IT firm, and we were also looking at the use of their products, so very much looking at how they marketed their products, sales, the sort of user experience of that, how they conceptualise the user within the firm, but then also to look at how people actually use these products and the feedbacks between the two. So I won't say very much on methods, but we did 15 in-depth interviews within the company, and we did a series of 24 in-depth interviews with, and we also used product use diaries with 12 users of the firm's computers, and also undertook ethnographic observation at various retail sites, you know, PC World, John Lewis, online sites as well. So, in terms of why we chose laptop computers, well, they're certainly not the biggest villain in terms of climate change, but it's certainly an area of very rapid growth, and certainly in terms of energy use. Laptop use in UK households has doubled in the last 5 years, and the average first lifespan of a laptop has decreased to just over 3 years, so that has an implication in terms of the amount of energy required to make these things. So we were quite focused in some ways on the replacement life of these products. Why was it decreasing? And the problems there. But also in terms of the actual domestic architecture, in terms of computing, how that's changed with wireless and the laptop, and how that's implicated in that, and what that means in terms of increased, decreased energy use. So having said that, in some ways the product category is to an extent irrelevant, because what we were really trying to get at was to explore some of the ways in which consumer practices are constructed by those of manufacturers and retailers. At present, we've got a situation where the sovereign consumer is seen as, you know, responsible for creating the demand for goods. And so one consequence of that, of course, is that we have policies geared towards shifting the consumption patterns in a more sustainable direction, very much focusing on changing the behaviour of individual consumers. But we would certainly argue that such interventions fail to consider the role of, you know, other actors, manufacturers, retailers, and the products themselves in shaping unsustainable patterns of demand. And certainly, we found the prevailing marketing paradigm was overtly structuralist, in that marketers view the market and consumers as kind of pre-formed, effectively denying their own involvement in constructing the markets that they see, you know, that they sought to sort of understand and respond to. So in terms of our theoretical points of departure, they're very much from a post-structuralist school of thinking. So elements of Vattel's actor network theory, Charvatel's practice theory, Michel Calon's economy of qualities, and Thrift et al.'s non-representational theory. So they're all drawn upon and hopefully feed back into to account for these links between the supply and demand sides. So, now, in terms of the outputs from the project, there's four papers in various stages of construction, you know, four themes that kind of emerged. And the ones, three and four there, in terms of how product qualities frame consumer demand and how laptop energy use in the home has changed. I'm not going to have a chance to talk about those today. I did try that once and I started hyperventilating because doing all four in 20 minutes was actually impossible. So I'm going to focus just on the first two there, because there's quite a good sort of relationship between these. Anyway, before I do that, firstly I want to actually outline, I hesitate to call it a model because I haven't drawn any boxes or arrows, so it probably doesn't qualify, but it's certainly something that emerged out of the research, and in terms of how the kind of marketers and the products and the use of them kind of went together. And then I'm going to try and flesh some of the parts of it out. So it's a bit small, but so to begin with, marketers and user experience experts receive product feedback from particular users, and we found that these were very much sort of the advanced creative user, despite attempts for it to be otherwise. Then, as a result, manufacturers innovate, putting better spec machines on the market because they believe there is demand for particular features. And this begins to create a rapid cycle of innovation. Consumers see this rapid pace of innovation, expect it to continue and accelerate, and concern the product will be obsolete very soon, purchase over-spec machines with features they don't need or use to give them headroom. The sales data tell the manufacturer that consumers are buying products with these new improved features, which they accept as evidence that these features are being used. This feeds back, this is where it should be a model, I should have just put an arrow back to 2, because we come back to 2. As a result, manufacturers continue to innovate, putting ever bigger spec machines on the market. This comes back to number 3, and so we can see the rapid pace of innovation just increasing, and they start to future-proof themselves. Comes back to 4, sales data to the man. So, you get the picture. This cycle becomes a kind of negative feedback loop, or positive, I'm not entirely sure. Where expectations on both sides come to play a key role. And so what I'm going to do with the rest of the time is briefly flesh out some parts of this kind of cycle before asking what it might add to debates on sustainable consumption. So I begin here with this idea of constructing the demanding user, so really beginning at the first point of that loop. So we talked to user experience experts within the firm, in terms of how they knew what people wanted in a product, how they tested their products. And they stated that they actually tried to be a bit scientific, as they said, but actually in reality, their choice of users was quite haphazard. And that they actually noted that what ended up happening was they sent out an email on the research site asking for families, individuals to become involved. So the people actually involved in the user research ended up being people who worked within the firm or were employees or friends of those who worked in the firm. So, and this has been referred to as the I methodology. And it was also relevant when we talked to these guys that they constantly referred to their own kind of use of the products as well. You know, how they would use it, what it meant to them. So this what's been termed the I methodology was also evident in more kind of evaluative research conducted by employees in category advertising environment, and they also all pointed to the ways in which they imagine consumers to be very much like themselves. And so there are 2 points really to make regarding that very inward focus. And then the first is that the users who take part in the research and give feedback are likely to be much more technologically literate than the average user. They'll have a better idea of what is technologically possible and higher expectations of what technology can do. And so these technologically kind of savvy consumers are very close to what the literature terms the advanced user, the early adopters, and certainly not representative of all users. And the second point is the way in which partial use and non-use is framed out by these methodologies and practices. Focus groups and even the product-focused kind of exploratory research always focus on use. Those who are not users or partial users are basically excluded. So that moves us on to this idea of the creative user, which is in some ways quite similar. But again, this was present in both kind of exploratory and evaluative research. User research experts narrated in relation, there was a study they did on netbooks with different children. And they showed how the more conservative, and these are some of their words, the conservative, traditional, and partial use of the product by the younger children was actually marginalised in their narrative in favour of what they called the more gripping, creative, and intensive use of the older children who used it. So despite this kind of exploratory emphasis, those users who were deemed to have limited imagination, and that's their term, and demonstrate conservative or partial use were framed out by the research team, and the product was then innovated according to this certain group of users. And so accounts like this suggest that designers and researchers pay attention to consumers not according to how well they represent consumers as a whole, but on the basis that they use the product and its features to its full potential, and thus highlight opportunities to, and these are their words again, to advance things, to push the boundaries, and invent a few product features in the process. And so there you have this idea of, you know, you could be looking at all types of use, but what actually gets focused on is a specific segment, really. And then moving on to sales data and product use. Now, the marketing and sales team in the UK had very little contact with Joe Bloggs, and instead they relied on the retailer, who effectively acts as the spokesperson for the end consumer. And this feedback could be face-to-face, but it was much more likely to be in the form of sales data, and the UK business relied heavily on two sets of sales data to inform their ideas about consumers and their use of the laptop. So, you know, we would argue that sales data within Mercury Computers, the firm in question, shares notions of use, leaving basic data on the specification, price and location. So which features are actually being used must, if at all, be inferred by the marketing team, who would then try and re-entangle these kind of specifications with lifestyle practices based upon segmentation models. And so although consumption is a complex and multi-stage process, it's still this purchase stage that continues to be the focus of attention, even though it's actually the post-purchase use and disposal phases that many of the sources of customer satisfaction are actually located. So excellent sales figures for a product don't guarantee customer satisfaction. They only indicate that the product appears to be the best solution available to consumers. And so the point, I think, to emphasise there is that these sales data visualise consumption and not use, and certainly not non-use or partial use. And so these sales data are a representation of the consumer rather than the user, and that's an important distinction. The consumer can be assumed to be using all the features of a product because they have purchased it, whereas the user is observed to only use some of those features. And this echoes work by Leslie Haddon, that a common attitude amongst companies is that success is measured simply in terms of increasing sales figures, and this is sufficient to show that products are meeting user demands. So the result of that kind of conflation is that even though many product features and innovations are unwanted and unused, the feedback that the firm receives is in a form that confirms the prevalence of all users as demanding and creative consumers, which is what they conceptualised in those initial kind of phases. And so the result of that narrowing of who and what counted as the user, it was succinctly summed up by one researcher within the company. He said the market has been driven, I suppose, by the techno-literate, and that maybe 20% of the market for laptops want the new features and the new operating system. As a result, it keeps developing. So you see it kind of at work. And what I think is important to emphasise there is the relationship between this construction of the consumer and the way this kind of pre-structures unsustainable consumption. And it does this because within the firm, this kind of a particular user is privileged with other users framed out at particular stages. And so in doing so, the company actually gives itself a mandate to innovate because it believes that its customers are more demanding than they really are. And as a result, the pace of innovation continues along a particular path and certainly accelerates. And this in itself is what I'm going to talk about next, conditions consumer expectations. So this next point, constructing consumer expectations. And this relates to, I'm going to skip back briefly, stage three here. This idea of consumers seeing the rapid pace of innovation, expecting it to continue and accelerate. Now, what we're trying to do here is make an argument about the way in which the replacement behaviour of consumers is in part constructed by companies through this continual innovation. So in the previous, what I just talked about, it was about continual innovation and how this is arrived at as a strategy through the market research and sales data. And now it's about showing how this strategy works in the marketplace to reproduce itself. So within the industry, consumer expectations are understood to be preformed rather than constructed through exposure to a particular market. This was one guy in the company. I think human nature defines that you don't want to stay still. I'm not a psychologist, and I need to look at my notes. It's like three guys in the US, and they were all cognitive and behavioural people, and they were saying that it's human rational behaviour to want to move on and not want to stay where you are. Now, let me back. Here, you've got the consumer enrolled alongside scientific evidence to suggest that it is rational human nature to want to move on and not stay still. So the existence of this expectant consumer serves to legitimate innovation as a natural course of action, and as such confirms to the manufacturer that continual innovation is normative and cannot and should not be stopped. However, I think we'd argue that if this expecting consumer does exist, then it's very much along the lines of Michel Calon's argument in terms of neoclassical man. Yes, they do exist, but they're not out there, you know, some natural being. They're actually kind of, over the course of years, they're formatted as such. So years of innovation in this industry has kind of had the effect that the consumer now expects constant change, and in fact, if they don't see it, they feel they're standing still. And we observe two responses in general to this kind of electronics arms race. There were a minority of consumers, and they were mainly women, who kind of felt paralysed by the pace of innovation. And one of them said to me, I think it was, technology moves pretty quickly, I, however, don't. You know, so that kind of summed that up. But there was also And their replacement behaviour was known to be slower. They'd keep a laptop for longer. However, there was a majority who had been conditioned by the pace of innovation in this and related industries, such as mobile phones. They also took account of what was happening in related industries to expect the market to move swiftly. So, you know, just some of the things that they said, it's kind of encapsulated it. You know, when he's talking about the electronics industry, something that affects us because the industry is so vast and things do change so quickly. It's always moved quickly, and when you think what's happened in the last 25 years, it's all been going, it's hardly started. So, you know, in terms of how that frames his expectations of what's going to happen tomorrow and in the future, so the dynamism of the industry creates this expectation of future dynamism. So as a result of that, the fact that like people like Robert, he knew there'd be a new, faster product, and many consumers, they acted to protect themselves from the impending obsolescence that implied by actually buying more than they needed. So many users bought laptops which they said were over-specced with features that they'd never used. So there's a couple here. Well, I'm really honest, it's over-specced. I wanted to use it for my computer, so I want to get bored of it. It has got DVDs and a 5-in-1 card reader, which are quite useful, though I hadn't actually used them. that's nice. This one's got an SD card reader and all that kind of stuff. Not that I use it, but I suppose that's what I'd be looking for, just to make sure. Good to have the option there, so in the future you want to use the machine for that and you've got that capability. It's kind of that idea, I suppose, you don't want to be suddenly out of date. How long do we have for time? 3 minutes. So, this idea of future-proofing, I think, it explains in part the decreasing replacement life of the laptop, which is now, I think, just under 3 years, because it helps to explain why people trade up prematurely with products which are beyond their needs in order to avoid impending obsolescence. So, in terms of a few conclusions where we might go from there, firstly, and being quite positive about this, I'd have to say that I think behaviour change policies focused at the individual will fail. So-called choices are so bound up in other networks that to act upon just one appears quite futile to me. I won't say too much more about that. Point number two. Theoretically, I think the work, you know, as I said, it draws upon these post-structuralist forms of theorising, and hopefully it kind of confirms and gives back to them that these are relevant lines of inquiry. So, and particularly this idea of the non-representational nature of consumer and market representations. So as something co-constructed rather than something just out there waiting to be, you know, apprehended and understood. So rather than the understandings of the consumer held by marketers, I've lost myself. It's the understanding that the representations that they produce, we would theorise is actually acting upon and constructing the very consumer that they're then trying to kind of describe and apprehend. So descriptions of the consumer and subsequent marketing strategies are non-representational. They do not present a pre-human reality, but that rather they are more than representational because they simultaneously construct reality and behaviours they seek to apprehend. Tim Cooper has done some interesting work on this in terms of replacement life, product lifespan. He stated that it's unrealistic to expect companies to start producing longer-lasting products until there is evidence of rising consumer demand or some form of regulatory imperative. However, as the present position of consumers is to a large extent framed by the actions of companies, without some kind of intervention, this situation will just perpetuate itself. I think intervention is required in order for consumer demand for alternative innovation paths to be recorded and realised. I mean, in the current climate, regulation, I would say, is probably out of the question, and it will be left to the market to decide. But as markets are currently structured to promote maximum consumption of products, it's hard to see that where that intervention can come. Now, I suppose... Okay, yeah. Should be doable. I think it has to come, any intervention has to come on the business side for me, with the introduction of much more, for example, in relation to this research, equitable and reflexive marketing and user experience paradigms within firms and universities as well. So these paradigms need to recognise and account for their role in constructing consumer behaviours. So, to give an example, it's likely that if Mercury Computers actually asked the average or partial user what they wanted, they would probably get something akin to Henry Ford's famous, if I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. Now, Henry Ford kind of scoffed at that, but I'm not sure it'd actually be such a bad thing. As I say, you know, Tim Cooper has written regarding the benefits that might accrue from slowing down the pace of so-called innovation, such as increased lifespans or changing the direction. So what you might find is that we end up with laptops where we have innovations in coding, which enable 10-year-old laptops to run an operating system really quickly, or modular laptops with a that are much more upgradable. These kind of paths of innovation that are currently not on the agenda. Okay, yeah. That'll do.